Welcome back to The Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. In his new book, leading Jimi Hendrix scholar Stephen Robey has uncovered and collected several forgotten or lost interviews the riotous guitarist gave during his too short heyday. Several themes that defined Hendrix's life emerge in its pages: isolation, his tough childhood, an always shifting biographical timeline, diffidence, and an often good sense of humor. The Southpaw guitar god is one of those rock and roll figures suspended in a state of permanent youth in the popular imagination because of his tragic death at just 27 in 1970. It's difficult to imagine, but that means Hendrix would have turned 70 this month. But the Hendrix myth has continued over the past four decades, with new music, new in quotation marks, having been released as recently as 2010. And his Monterey Pop and Woodstock performances are still referenced with every smash guitar or wah-wah national anthem. Hendrix on Hendrix, Interviews and Encounters with Jimi Hendrix, which is published by Chicago Review Press, is a chance to revisit a time when fame, critical accolades, and the swirling 60s converged on the Seattle-born guitarist. Stephen Robey, welcome to the Roundtable.
Hey, good morning. It's great to be on your show.
When you were going through the collection of these interviews and putting them in order, what did you learn about Jimi Hendrix? Because you've already written several books on him, and I assume you know more details than most people. So what surprised you in these interviews?
Hendrix on Hendrix starts with an interview done shortly after he arrived in England. He was struggling for so many years to make it in America, playing with the likes of Little Richard, Joey D, and the Starlighters, and the Isley Brothers, and finally got a chance to go to England where, you know, it was happening back then with the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, and he was brought over there and almost had instant success overnight. They were just dying to have an authentic African-American guitar player who could play the blues like Jimmy did, you know, just, you know, blow them away. So what I learned putting this compilation together of his interviews from 66 to 1970 was I started to see a shift in Jimmy's character, especially around the years 69 to 70, when he, you know, this constant touring and marathon sessions in the recording studio finally caught up with him. He was just being worn down, and you can hear it in the tone of his voice there, especially toward the end, that the guy was really becoming very in a fragile state. And you hear that especially in this last interview done just about a week before he died.
It's interesting because he doesn't seem to enjoy the interview process the more it happens. And yet, because of his growing fame, his handlers and his managers and his management seemed to want to have him interviewed all the time. So while he didn't enjoy that, this has served as a repository of information for you several decades later.
That's true. I'm glad you bring that up, too. His management would allow just about anybody to interview him. There's a lady by the name of Nancy Carter who was doing her master thesis at the University of Southern California, who wanted to include some Hendrix quotes in her thesis, and she approached Hendrix's management, and they said yes. There's several other opportunities when students who were going to college writing for the student newspaper wanted to interview Hendrix, and management said okay, too. And so you get a different perspective with all these different interviewers, if you will, approaching Hendrix and getting access to some of his thoughts.
You alluded to the change in tone in Hendrix, and late in the book, there's a very striking moment where he says he's not sure if he'll live to be 28. Of course, he died at 27. What did that come from?
Well, you know, part of it is that he really never had a place to call home. He left a broken home situation in Seattle when he was just turning 18. He'd been arrested twice for joyriding. His mother died at 16. His father drank a lot. So he was ready to get out of Seattle. And one of his opportunities to get out of Seattle was to join the U.S. Army at the time. But, you know, shortly after being there for only about a year and a half, he realized that the Army wasn't suited for him. And music was his passion. So he continued to follow that, but then, you know, success came to bite him, and he became a world superstar. So all these years of touring and everything finally caught up with him, and he realized that, you know, he just wanted to find a way out of it. And, you know, if he kept at that rapid pace, that he wouldn't live to see 28. And so he was looking for a way to perhaps retire or find a different avenue of staying in the recording business, perhaps as just a producer, and continue on.
Well, what do you think would have happened had he lived? I mean, his contemporaries are still playing today, so it's kind of interesting to imagine, would Jimi Hendrix be on tour right now the way Dylan is at 70 years old, with how much despair in the music industry he was feeling at 27?
Of course, you know, if he had lived, I think we would have seen some incredible jazz rock fusion albums. There were definitely some opportunities for him to record with the great Miles Davis. He loved Ross on Roland Kirk, and jammed with him several times. There was a project with Quincy Jones, the great producer, and Gil Evans, too, wanted to drag him into the recording studio. So I think in the 70s, we would have seen Hendrix step out of the psychedelic rock sound and get into kind of a jazz rock fusion sound. There's certainly evidence, too, that he was playing with some of the early forms of rap music, although it wasn't called rap then. It was called jail toast, which was kind of an early form of rap music where prisoners in the South would do this rhyme that was that later developed into rap music. And, you know, I kind of tend to think back to earlier this year when President Obama had this rhythm and blues concert at the White House, and the likes of B.B. King and Jeff Beck and Mick Jagger and Jimmy's contemporaries at the time were playing music. And at one point there, a song was played called Catfish Blues, which Hendrix included in his repertoire in the early part of his career there. And President Obama is nodding his head and even knew the words to that song there. And so I was imagining at the time, gosh, if Jimmy lived, he would certainly be playing the White House in front of President Obama and playing Catfish Blues.
You know, one of the joys of reading these interviews is how often you, as the editor, have inserted sick where a biographical fact is wrong in one of the contemporary accounts. Why was his chronology so incorrect at the time?
Right, exactly. Well, part of that was due to management. Hendrix's management didn't want him to be portrayed as somebody in their mid-20s when, you know, if you were in your early 20s, just turning 21 instead of 25, you were more likely to be a success with the kind of the young 18 to 20 crowd. And so they kind of fibbed about Jimmy's age there. And Hendrix sort of portrayed up that, you know, that he spent time in the Army and broke his ankle when he was trying to get out, when the fact is that once his guitar showed up at the Army barracks there, his father sent him his guitar from Seattle there, that Jimmy just gave up his desire to become a soldier and wanted to get out as soon as possible and start playing in the clubs around Nashville, Tennessee.
How did his time as a background musician influenced the way he approached life as a frontman when he did break free?
Well, that's the point where he really learned his chops there. He became a strong rhythm player. And when he started to break out there, and especially when he was playing with Little Richard there, he wanted to dress more flamboyantly like Little Richard was at the time, turned his guitar up, started growing his hair long. And the worst part of it was that he broke the strict band dress code at the time. If you recall, most of the groups back then had to wear a uniform of like a white jacket, a black tie, black pants, and shiny leather shoes. And Hendrix wasn't buying that at the time. He wanted to wear ruffle shirts, flashy cufflinks, and grow his hair kind of long, almost in the style of the Beatles then, back in 1965. And he would get fined constantly and eventually fired. And at one point during his time during the R&B circuit tours there, they got so fed up with him. The bands at the time used buses to tour the country. One of the other guitar players in one of the other groups took his guitar and threw it out the window, and it smashed into a million pieces on some dusty country road.
Stephen Roby, you write in the introduction to this book that you've been hooked on Hendrix since about age 12 when he came over the radio. What is it about him that fascinates you so much?
Well, you know, that music just grabbed a hold of me. I mean, I grew up during the Haight-Ashbury days in San Francisco, and it just struck a note with me, if you will, back then. It sounded entirely different than the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. And when I finally got a glimpse of what the guy looked like and how he played the guitar, and he really took chances, that has just stayed with me all these years. In fact, I've taught a class on Hendrix's life and music at a local college, and I decided to write a Hendrix fanzine for almost 10 years and went to work for the family of Jimi Hendrix. And I never give up on this. I once attempted to break the Guinness Book of World Records and get 3,000 guitar players to play Purple Haze in San Francisco's Golden Gate Park. Right now, we only got about 500, but it was great to see families, all different ages, out there bringing their guitars, honoring Jimmy. So, I don't know, something about his passion, the guy took chances, and I just don't hear that in today's music. I mean, today's music, the artists seem to have a very short shelf life. The music is predictable, and there's very little solos like Hendrix would take guitar solos in his songs. You just don't hear that anymore.
Is there anything left to learn about Hendrix's life? I mean, is there more for you to uncover out there?
I think so. You know, there's a lot to be still investigated about how he died. I mean, why he died. We know how he died, but we don't really know all the details of why he died. We do know that he was with a very naive young lady at the time who had grand aspirations of becoming his fiance and eventually his wife. But there's some uncounted hours still left that we may never know but need to be investigated further.
That's Stephen Roby. He's the editor of a new book called Hendrix on Hendrix, Interviews and Encounters with Jimi Hendrix. And it's been a real pleasure to have you on the roundtable and continued good work in your Hendrix investigations.
Thanks, and thanks for having me on.
Listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.